You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 42, where we are discussing the Barbara Levitt and James March 1988 article, Organizational Learning, that appeared in the Annual Review of Sociology. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph Soul coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
And this is Dimitris, live from Brighton in the UK.
This is Tom calling in from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Pedro coming to you from Brasilia, Brazil's capital, in a beautiful sunny day.
And this is Miranda coming to you from Leamington Spa in the UK.
Welcome, everybody. This is the first episode of Season 5, and we've chosen, I think, a very important and interesting article. Its title is Organizational Learning by Barbara Levitt and James March, appeared in the 1988 edition of the Annual Review of Sociology. I'm going to start out with a brief description of the authors. I found things on James March. I could not find very much on Barbara Levitt, so that'd be a bit spare. James March, who was born in 1928, he's the Jack Steele Parker Professor Emeritus at Stanford University and the Stanford Graduate School of Education. He's best known for his research on organizations, but he has written widely. March is highly respected for his broad theoretical perspective that combines theories from psychology and other behavioral sciences. As a core member of the Carnegie School, he collaborated with cognitive psychologist Herbert Simon and several others on works in organizational theory. I don't have nearly the extensive background on Barbara Levitt other than to say, well, she's the lead author on this article, and she has contributed to other papers, but I don't know where she's studying nor what she's doing now.
An interesting note about James March is that he does like the podcast, but he refuses to participate in it no matter what.
Yeah, that's a challenge because we have other people we've asked who don't want to participate for some similar kinds of reasons or their technology challenge. I'm not sure what March's reason is, but we'd love to have him on if he changes his mind.
Yes, it's a shame, but he's always more than welcome.
All right. My summary of the article starts out with the authors describing organizational learning as learning by encoded inferences from history into routines that guide behavior. And that's I think a nice way to summarize it because we have inferences, history, routines, and behavior. The article is a literature review, so we'll talk later about the fact that it's light on empirical data, but that's not why they wrote it. They wrote it to review the literature and its implications for organizational learning. And they made three observations based on their review of the behavioral studies of organizations. Behavior is based on routines. Organizations match procedures to situations, and they don't necessarily calculate the optimum choice for a situation. Routines are established over time and used for the future based on past experiences, and that's covered quite thoroughly in the article. Number two, actions are history dependent. Routines are interpretations of the past rather than anticipations of the future. And three, the learning is oriented to targets. Targets play an important role in Levitt and March's conception of organizational learning. Behavior depends on the relation between outcomes observed and the aspirations of those outcomes. They describe routines to include all the rules, procedures, practices, conventions, and strategies that organizations have historically used and still use based on past experiences. This form of organizational learning is formed more on the basis of past experience than future goals. Now, here's some of the key ideas from the text. First, about organizational memory. They discuss organizational memory, which they describe as a way in which organizations preserve useful information and key ideas from past experience. There's a danger in relying on organizational memory, as they note, because there's a lot of tacit knowledge involved in organizational memory, and the tacit knowledge can become subjective and be missing key ideas or information. They go on to explain that the less used information that is in organizational memory runs a risk of becoming lost. And organizational memory can become lost if the organization has a high turnover of personnel, That's one of the examples, but there's other reasons for that. Another thing they talk about, another I think that's a key theme from the text, is superstitious learning, which I thought was very interesting. This occurs when members of an organization make persistent but faulty interpretations about the connections between actions and outcomes. Superstitious learning is based on looking at a cause and effect relationship, but the difficulty lies in looking at limited amounts of information, and then people can have different interpretations that can then mislead the organization. The third really interesting theme I thought was this notion of competency traps. Yeah, organizations can fall into competency traps when they experience success with a specific strategy or procedure, but this doesn't necessarily mean that it's the most effective strategy, however that's determined, or the best procedure to achieve long-term effects. And you often see organizations clinging to things that worked in the past or perhaps suboptimal strategies and have difficulty learning or developing new ones. And in this competency trap, the organization continues to use the inadequate procedure because their immediate returns are beneficial or they're perceived as beneficial. The article provides critical lessons about the implications of organizational behaviors on adaptive learning. And the authors find organizations often behave in ways that limit the utility of learning. And primarily this occurs through behaviors that act to reinforce incrementalized learning and emphasizing short-term outcomes, which sometimes are called single-loop learning, at the expense of reflecting on broader implications of the assumptions or maybe even stating the assumptions. A lot of organizations have challenges with that, operating by assumptions that nobody really talks about out loud. And this has been echoed by others in the field of organizational learning, like Argyris and Schoen and Flood. Yeah, Tom, I think that's a great observation, because if you just look at learning as an outcome, then you're going to miss a lot of those really important process aspects of it that strongly affect, according to this work here, what you're going to get out of the learning that's going on. And that's what I like the way they broke it down into the things that affect the process.
So a few words about the context of the paper in the podcast. As the listeners probably know, we have this Carnegie Mellon series special in which I think every season we manage to read a different piece by someone affiliated to that stream of research. And it's very interesting because throughout the time, I think we have been able to explore different facets of that school. You know, we talked about learning in the past, but in reference to exploration, exploitation, about design, about routines. And I think now we are starting to see in these texts a kind of a different facet of the Carnegie Mellon. The Carnegie Mellon was very important for the development of the more scientific approach to management and the studies of organization. You know, if we think about it, we come from a more practitioners-oriented literature, people like Taylor, Parker Follett. You know, it's very much about the experience they had as people involved in organizations. And the Carnegie Mellon has contributed to our field by trying to maybe formalize, instill a certain kind of aura of science into these discussions, which I think is both good, but also has some risks, because as we know, the earlier work is very much based on propositions and formal issues. And I think what's interesting in this text, because it is based on a review of the literature, I see that the authors are trying to kind of, you know, merge a certain attention for formalized kind of proposition-oriented kind of look into organizations and having to come to terms with empirical findings from organizations, from empirical studies. And it's, I think the text very much shows that kind of, you know, interlink.
Yeah, one of the things that I found very interesting in that too is that when I look at one sentence that's there on page 333, and that's how they're defining learning as a process and not an outcome. And I think that that's a very, very important statement, because in colloquial use, you know, in the field, when we talk about learning, sometimes the use of the term focuses more on outcome than it does on process, or that the two are together. And this article, as they're trying to define and present the totality of what was known in 1988 about organizational learning, they take only the process side. And I think that could leave us to some questions to explore in later parts. it's a good orientation for the purposes of this article. At least I felt that there was a consistent look at this is the how of the way that organizations take information and translate it into routines, translate it into memory, basically the process of trying to capture what the organization's trying to do.
I think it's also worth noting for the benefit of our listeners about the enduring value of this paper, that even though it's pretty much as old as I am, the insights and the descriptions of learning, memory, and routines, even though the latter one is something I have a bit of an issue with that we'll discover in part two, they're still very current, or they are current again in a kind of contemporary cutting edge, if you will, research that's happening now. So it's, if you haven't read this work and you do anything remotely related to organizational learning, memory, or kind of how information persists through time and space, this is certainly a must read. It's an amazing, amazing work, really timeless.
I had a note on what Tom said regarding the emphasis on process, because interestingly, I think this is also a hallmark of the Carnegie Mellon tradition, which has been this commitment to looking at the functioning of organizations, or more to look at looking at the dynamics that happen in organizations as something that is specific and emergent, you know, so going beyond a pure economist or psychological perspective that are just humans or just actions or decisions, but actually organizations have something particular about them that make these actions and decisions and learning in this case, you know, to have to be understood at how it happens there. Having said that, it's funny because I also feel that the writing doesn't capture that so much, or maybe it doesn't capture in light of the ideas we have about today of processual research.
No, but I mean, on the one hand, it makes sense that they're so process oriented because they're, one of their main things is routines, right? You can't think of routines in non-processual terms. But I agree with you. Unless you consider routines very closely in the way that they define them, which is, and I'll quote here from the paper, that the generic term routines includes the forms, rules, procedures, conventions, strategies, technologies around which organizations are constructed. It also includes beliefs, frameworks, paradigms, codes, cultures, knowledge that buttress, elaborate, and contradicts the formal routines. Basically, for them, routines is kind of everything, right? I think you couldn't fit more stuff into this definition within this paper. That's a great point.
It includes about everything that goes on in organizations.
Yeah. So it's this umbrella term for basically an organization. And unless you keep this truckload of concepts and phenomena in mind while reading the paper, it doesn't really come off processual at all. So I agree with you there.
Yeah. So I think maybe the term would be more about a dynamic view. You know, I feel it's very much about system dynamics here. I'm not an expert, but that's how I feel that they are relating to. It's very much a systemic view, and there's the idea that routines are the building blocks that move the parts along that make the, you know, the machine turn, so to speak, in more mechanic terms.
Going off of episode 41, I noticed that you're using the machine metaphor in interpreting this paper.
Yes.
Nicely stated. Gareth Morgan would be proud.
This is curious because I was reading it more from a brain metaphor. For me, this is a very cognitivistic view of organizations.
I think it has aspects of both.
Yes, exactly. I agree.
Yeah, that's the thing with metaphors, but it's still an interesting difference that we have in interpreting. Could it be that your bureaucratic background is playing into...
No, I think just to defend myself a bit, I think the idea is that I see it as a system, so I agree with the idea of the brain, but I think that the brain they're talking about is a more mechanistic one, because the routines are very much these building blocks that are doing specific things, you know, so it is on the verge of both, I think, perspectives.
I love that, Pedro, a mechanistic brain. Nicely stated.
I smell the rise of the machines.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting because I did pick up on this kind of dual nature. So there's one part which is quite mechanic, if you want to call it with this term, but then there is, in between the lines, you can still read into something that could hint at a cognitive perspective. So, for instance, if you take this idea of learning, so confirming certain routines that belong to the past based on the idea if they are successful or if they're not successful, you also have a section which is specifically devoted to the ambiguity of success. So what does success mean? And as much as it does refer to performance measures, it also kind of hints at the fact that performance may not be the only thing in a tangible way. So it also asks yourself, okay, so what does the organization want to achieve and what does it consider success? And it also builds into the political nature of the organization, the specific people that are involved. And I found that quite interesting, considering links with other streams of literature. So I don't know. It was a part that I found quite fascinating.
Well, I think that's really interesting, because I also saw that human dynamic where there, you know, people have different agendas. I didn't quite say it that way, but I think that's something it's a word I'm using, and because of people's past experience, they get these feelings that everything they do is right, or that, you know, that's how they became successful in the organization. So it made me a little bit more sympathetic to some, you know, senior managers who often will just see one way of doing things because that's the world they grew up in, and therefore that may be just the way they see the world, is the fact that they've had all this great experience and that influences how they learn. And I also thought these competing agendas making organizational learning kind of a tangle of things to unravel.
What I was thinking of was, for instance, the case of businesses whose mission isn't solely the generation of profit. So typically, I don't know, social entrepreneurs or even family businesses, where there is more this idea of leaving a legacy or building a reputation, consolidating the family and so on around the business.
I don't think that's an impediment to this paper, specifically because...
No, not an impediment, absolutely not. It's something phrased in such a way that can open up and can relate to other streams of literature quite neatly.
I think that somewhere in the paper, I don't remember exactly where, they insist on this idea that organizations are, you know, this kind of mechanisms or brains or, I don't want to say things, but, you know, they are designed to with specific goals in mind. And, you know, the paper is not specific on how different the goals can be, but now that we have a lot of research, as Miranda was referring to, multiple kinds of organizations, hybrid kinds of organizations, I think that kind of links that.
But they do mention that in the context of learning, that there can be nested levels, especially with asymmetric power, kind of indirectly alluding to this idea that organizations are not as monolithic as Carnegie Mellon tends to portray them. So, you know, that's a good thing. But it could have been... I think organizational learning, at least from what we know now, and, you know, you and me, Pedro, were coming from this tradition very explicitly, it's far more intricate, complex, and complicated than kind of what's outlined here. And not to say that what's outlined in this work is somehow basic or uninteresting, quite on the contrary, but there's so much more to it. The power struggles, the competition for resources, the political aspects that they hint upon but don't really go into much detail, they make up a lot of the landscape and texture that goes with organizational learning that we know and recognize today.
Yeah. In some passages, I almost felt that the paper had two heads, you know, and I actually felt a lot in the papers overall, because in the setup, they talk about this idea of how learning comes from trial and error of routines, and if the routine is successful and is associated to success, then it's going to be kept or not, you know. So it seems it's going to be very much a story that it's all about, you know, evaluating very neatly, as if politics did not play a part. But then as we read, you know, they actually bring, at least they hint at how there are these different ideas rivalry within organizations. So it's interesting that it seems almost, again, on the verge of these two, I think, perceptions.
Right. Well, let's take it from the top. So they say right from the beginning that organizational learning can be distinguished, but is also related to theories of calculation and intention, conflict and bargaining, and variation selection. So right there we have this three-dimensional picture of learning that includes both the planning, essentially, then the competition and politics, but also kind of this relationship to survival of what fits better. So this is the organizational learning as a process, and then the interpretation of it is specifically based on routines, logic of appropriateness and legitimacy, and on how history dependent these actions are. So straight away from the top, we have this three-dimensional kind of picture of what learning is, but also the more contextual, subjective kind of add-on of what organizations would make with it.
Well, I think what I would say is it's a very rich description or a rich playing field they're describing, and that may be one of the reasons why it's so important and cited so highly in the works that follow, because they really get at some of these things that can be explored much more deeply.
I read that the article was taking a lot of the mechanisms of organizational learning, and then they put a sort of a umbrella brain metaphor wrapper over it. So I kind of saw it as they were taking all of these different pieces of understanding how organizations routinize activity and learn from their history, and then the way to explain it was to put it under a broader metaphor. But I think a point I wanted to follow up with on process versus outcome. This is not, you know, they said that they defined organizational learning as a process and not an outcome. But no question, outcome, you can't read this paper without understanding that they definitely have a sense of what outcome means. And a good example of this was on page 321, as they start talking about experiences and essentially the flaws that individuals have in capturing their experience. This is sort of a sense of that, okay, the process is the process, and the outcome can be good, bad, or extremely bad. There's no valence necessarily attached to it. You hope that the outcome is favorable, that learning as a process would lead to better outcomes, but they throughout the paper, and I'm sorry, I misquoted the phrase. It's actually on page 323 when they started talking about how individual human beings are not perfect statisticians, which leads to all sorts of misinterpretations of history that, as they get embedded into routines, lead to bad habits. When those of us who are working organizational change, part of the first things we try to look at is if the outcomes are bad, okay, what was the learning process that produced the bad habit? And can we go back and figure out what went wrong?
Yeah, I love that whole idea of this, that learning from experience is equivocal and actually contested. Throughout the article, they almost have a differentiated view of learning, that some parts of the organization will learn different things, or as we said before, it depends on agendas. And I thought their sentence, it's at the bottom of 323, and they're talking about interpretation of experience, and they say, these attributes of individuals as historians are important to the present topic because they lead to systematic biases in interpretation. And I've seen in organizations I've worked in before where somebody will make a claim that they've learned from experience this thing, and it makes me want to wrinkle up my face and say, how did you get that exactly? You know, what was it that you were looking at? So I'm not saying they were wrong, but it was an interpretation that was completely different than mine, and kind of made me aware. I mean, I used to think they were just wrong, but now I realize, they have just a different view because they're looking at different attributes of the experience.
And they also captured the problem of overdetermination. Certainly in where I'm working, and we're dealing with complex topics and complex organizational behaviors, and the tendency to want to find a deterministic cause of something that went wrong. They captured that, you know, not even in the context necessarily of complex adaptive systems. And it's it's a very important concept for, you know, when you're trying to capture the rules in which organizations are under that cause them to determine that this particular effect or the problem that they're facing was caused by something, when the cause is obviously going to be very complicated.
So my note was simply that it seems that they are talking about all these issues as if they depend on the cognitive capacity of humans. Again, humans are not perfect statisticians, but your example, Rolf, is great because when someone just says, I'm doing this out of experience, there is always the question of the politics or the interests that are being played at, and that you can leverage these concepts and actually be, you know, blaming or putting the fault on human capacity or whether you see the same way, but actually there might be more hidden agendas, so to speak, on, you know, behind actions and decisions.
Right. I mean, that occurs at multiple levels. And that's why I think the learning can be equivocal, because they talk about these different perceptions that people have, not only because of their agendas, but just because sometimes it's not, they were talking about earlier in the article about that there's no one best place to observe these things. So it's not always clear in the organization what the causality was and who was involved, but people are still going to come to some conclusions based on that. What I was thinking when Tom was talking about this deterministic cause for change or problems or those kinds of things is making me think of that I've seen a very strong drive in organizations for fairly simple explanations. They don't really address that in the article, but I think it's there. People looking for deterministic outcomes and going backwards and say, okay, it must be that guy or that woman who touched the button last. And I think they refer to it indirectly when they talk about these suboptimal learning or suboptimal processes where I think there's that great risk where if you look for a simple solution, yep, you can come up with a simple causality, or I guess a better way is, you know, simple causality, you can then produce simple solutions, which may not be variegated enough to have a good match with your environment. And we've seen that in some of the prior readings that we've done.
And if I can add just one other thing, this also ties in to discussions on attribution theory. So this idea that individuals have different ways of attributing failures or successes, and depending on, I don't know, cognitive personality traits, there could be a sense of having a tendency to blame the external environment, or in the case of success, saying, okay, it was actually my job and, you know, I did a very good job on that. But there's an entire conversation around attributions in the sense of the determination of what causality was at the root of success or failure.
Well, and that's a wonderful description of what they talk about, the sort of political aspect of interpreting history, right? If you're a newcomer and you don't have a lot of invested in the prior ways of doing business, you're going to have a tendency to criticize more strongly than if you've been there for a while or you came up with the process, and then you're going to have this attribution of, well, it was, you know, I had a good process, but it was external events, you know, that caused the downfall. So I think there's that political and power relationship that also impacts that learning.
It's interesting. Now that I heard what Miranda said, I think I understand what I was trying to say.
I think she said it better than you did, which always happens to me too.
Yes, exactly. Yes, she said it better. No, but that's why the podcast is great, you know, because we learn from each other so much, and we hope the listeners too. But I think the author has very much this model that is very psychological. It's very much about the human, you know. It's very much about the person and the organization. I don't see a lot of sociological discussions at group level. So I think that's why I was hitting at this point, that I don't see the politics, because it's not, yes, you can see these attribution issues, whether the leader is going to perceive that what they do is better than, you know, what someone else is doing. But it's also at the level of the individual. It's never at the level of the department, the group at work, you know, the community of the occupational community, and what them as engineers or accountants or HR people are going to perceive about the other communities and about themselves. So I think that's what I see that's missing in the paper and the discussion.
But I think there is something along the lines of this idea that targets change over time, and that also the definition of the targets is by nature political. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, even if we look at the academic environment, is it more important to submit a work on time or a high quality work under the assumption that working on it in a kind of speedily may not mean high quality? That's the example that comes to my mind on an everyday basis. And it's a decision that it's made within the organization, but not necessarily the leader, or maybe the leader.
So I think what I'm trying to say is that the point that, you know, I would be interested in, and I think that's what the paper and I think the Carnegie Mellon tradition don't focus so much, is that between your decision as an academic and the interests of the organization as a whole, there are different groups that have different ideas on what it is, you know, that so for instance, for some academics, it's all about publishing certain venues, or in others, it will be more about writing books, you know. So even within being an academic, there is going to be a more group level, I think, kind of, level of that the things get played and discussed. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well, I think that what was coming to mind as you were talking, Pedro, was that when you have, say, two different groups within the organization, and they don't necessarily have to be any part of the formal structure, they're just two groups of members who have vastly different interests, and they'll set different targets or define the targets different ways, and therefore define success different ways. And that is a part of the discussion about ambiguity of success that I think was lacking because of the perspective that they took about, you know, the individual defining success. You can have in-groups and out-groups, of course, within organizations. We've talked about that in previous episodes. And the way in which each defines and redefines the target may serve a dual purpose, which is to claim success or attribute failure, and to ensure that boundary between success and failure, you know, remains firmly defined between the in-group and the out-group. So I change the targets to suit my desire to appear to be successful and blame others for the problems.
And it also incorporates the external environment, where organizations read off of their competitors and collaborators to the same end.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because when I started the article, I didn't realize that they were going to go down that path. And I think that really helped give a fuller picture of the organizational learning, because if you don't see if you're not connected to what your competitors are doing, you're leaving out a lot of the ability to learn important things, or maybe bad things, hard to say. And then they had that whole section about if you're powerful enough to create your own environment, you know, you're going to learn certain things, maybe close to external environment. I think that was a real important insight.
They have an interesting insight where they talk about the ecologies of learning, and they say that the learning outcomes depend on the number of competitors, the rates at which they learn from their own experience, the rates at which they adjust their targets, the extent to which they learn from the experience of others, and the differences in the potentials of the technologies. And then they add that there is a tendency for organizations to specialize and for faster learners to specialize in inferior technologies, which is puzzling, I think.
Yeah, and I had a little trouble with that one.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about why would that be the case? Why is it that if you learn faster, that necessarily means that the technology you use for learning or operating is inferior? And again, inferior to what and in which way? But it seems to betray us this maybe a function of times and maybe a function of Carnegie Mellon, certain technological determinism or technological romanticism that they have, that as long as the technology is sophisticated enough, not only does it require more effort in some kind of a linear way to master, but it also is better. And we know that that's just not the case.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a time-based bias, right? Not only is that a worldview, but also that's kind of what the world looked like at the time. And we see now that definitely there's many situations where the technology is more sophisticated, gives you more things to do, and it's not necessarily harder to learn or requires all this extra effort they're talking about.
This is taking me back a bit to our episode, well, our episodes on high reliability theory, and specifically where we talked about the contrast between, Ralph, help me out, the Pfeffer's view of kind of catastrophism, that
sufficiently
complex technology will almost inevitably lead to some kind of catastrophic failure because it's just too complicated.
Right, and that's the Charles Perrow view. Complication transparency or lack thereof, right? Yeah.
And then we had the high reliability counterpoint that no, that doesn't have to be this way as long as you have as long as you can defer to individuals and kind of collective mechanisms, in an appropriate way.
Right.
They don't go into that here, but this interesting note about technology and environment is puzzling.
Well, the other thing I was thinking that as part of this puzzlement, or maybe just the way they see organizations, is I think that they're looking at more traditional like organizations, where really since the late 80s when they wrote this, and we're probably thinking about it even earlier, there's been this enormous rise of project-based kinds of organizations. And a lot of these things where you have a lot of fluidity of people going back and forth and a lot of engagement with the environment and smaller teams working on projects. I don't know if a lot of this applies in those kinds of situations. I'm not saying it doesn't apply at all. I'm just saying from many of the descriptions of organizations, it appears they're looking at large, stable organization and producing the same kind of product year after year, or with some innovation, but not where you're, creating, situations so project teams can specifically learn. One of the examples that comes to mind is when IBM, a very large bureaucratic organization, had been making the same kinds of products for years and years. And it was in the late, mid to late 80s, where they said, we want to develop a personal computer. They actually, when they created the project team, they specifically moved them away from headquarters to Boca Raton, Florida. They had a site there, but they put them in a separate building so they could learn without being impacted by the larger organizational forces. I mean, that was one of the things. It wasn't the only reason, but that occurred to me. And so that just seems to be something that wasn't a big part of the world at the time. And as Pedro was saying, perhaps not part of the Carnegie Mellon school. And therefore, the article in that respect is a bit dated.
It's interesting because we can talk about that more in the second part. But that's what I'm trying to get at with my comment. I see the individual. I see the organization. I don't see the variety within the organization.
Yeah.
So exactly. I don't see the different projects happening of the different kind of specialists that are involved in different kind of tasks. And also the learning becomes a bit more problematic because it's hard to go from individual to the whole level because there are so many other, separations, units, and specializations happening.
That's a great point. And we should talk about that in part two.
I am not an expert in organizational learning. I know a bit from my master's studies, but it's not a theory or an area that I've specialized in for research. So I have to admit that I was pleasantly surprised when I opened the article, and it started off with a very kind of what I thought was going to be rooted in economics. So I immediately saw a formula and I was like, okay, this is going down one route. And then exploring the article in more details, there are more cognitive perspectives. There is this even an idea of sense making, if you'd like to stretch it, and also a more systemic ecological approach. And I found it a very fascinating article for how it actually manages to entail a series of perspectives and go down routes that I really didn't expect. So I was very, very happy with the reading.
Yep, same here. I think it's a great article. I think I do actually come from organizational learning and specifically organizational memory background. And even with all the things that kind of make me a bit uncomfortable knowing what I know now, looking at it as it is, and even considering it in kind of introductory to intermediate context to organizational learning and memory, this is a fantastic paper. It's easy to read. It covers a lot of ground in the little space that it takes up. And it's still fairly relevant and still fairly accurate with respect to the fundamental principles and the basics of the ideas that come into learning and memory. It does have some biases that I mentioned, specifically the cognitivist bias, kind of looking at organization in more of a brain type of a metaphor in that sense. And we'll get to that in part two. But overall, this is great. And I'm happy that we're starting season five with this. I would certainly encourage our listeners who may not be familiar with this work to just go and read it. It's brief, it's great, it's easily consumable.
I don't have much to add other than to James March, if he's listening to us, that, you know, I'm actually curious to know whether we can classify this reading into the Carnegie Mellon tradition, because to me, following what Miranda said, it seems very much to be almost bridging paradigms, you know, trying to go to this more form or proposition-based kind of way of talking about organizations and incorporating empirical research and, as you said, the more cognitive, more richer way of, you know, taking account of what really goes on inside organizations.
And that's all for part one of episode 42. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Levitt and March's organizational learning paper here on Talking About Organizations.